Okay, chapter 14, A Tale of Two Bumblebees. God never established any religion. We'll get to the two bumblebees in just a minute. First, I wanted to follow up on a few linguistic issues that had come up in past weeks. Last week, Vicky raised a very interesting question regarding Acts 11:20 and the discussion about the gospel being to the Jew first. Do you remember what you said, Vicky?
There was something in the book about nobody bringing the news to the Gentiles initially. Like Peter wasn't doing it, and Paul wasn't doing it, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else was doing it. But the passage that I found seems to indicate that there were some people who were doing it.
Okay, right. Basically, on pages 174 and 175, the presentation here is basically that all the people who were sharing the good news went to the Jews and didn't even really think about going to the Gentiles. And this continues through, I think it's Acts 13, when in Antioch of Pisidia, Paul and Barnabas decide to go much more actively to the Gentiles as well. And they, if you look at that passage, you'll see that they view it as a fulfillment of prophecy in the Tanakh, interestingly. But Vicky found a passage before that in Acts 11:20, which says that some of the disciples began proclaiming the good news to Greeks, which raises an interesting issue. In some translations, it may say Gentiles. In other translations, it may say Hellenist Jews. Probably in this case, it's Hellenist Jews that are being described. Just as in, I think it's Acts 6, if you look at the dispute that arose between the different kinds of widows, the Hebraic and the Hellenist widows, it's probably talking about Hebraic Jews and Hellenist Jews. There were both kinds at the time. And so I see some people already want to comment on it, but to outline the situation very briefly, unfortunately, with regard to the word Greek, it's a very similar situation in the Messianic writings as with regard to the word Jew. In other words, sometimes it means one thing and sometimes it means another thing. Sometimes it refers to Hellenist Jews, or the Jews who had adopted Greek civilization, Greek language, and so forth. Sometimes it's used to refer to Gentiles as distinct from Jews. It doesn't usually refer, as we might think, to people who are Greeks from Greece. It refers to people who are of Greek civilization and Greek culture. Sometimes that means Hellenist Jews. Sometimes that means Gentiles as distinct from Jews. So unfortunately, here there's also an issue of interpretation and translation. I looked at it in the New American Standard Version, and they have a note saying that in some manuscripts, it actually says Greek-speaking Jews. So probably that's the appropriate interpretation for this particular case. Jessica, were you going to add something? Oh, I thought you were raising your hand.
No, I think I had my hand in my...
Oh, okay.
Good thing you weren't at an auction.
So,
you know what we did.
But I did pass this on to my father, so hopefully... if there's a second edition, it could be included. I don't think it changes the overall pattern, but it's definitely something to consider because there's not 100% certainty with that. Mm-hmm. When we were looking in that chapter at Romans 1:16, and that also says to the Jew first and also to the Greek. So it's a question of interpretation there. Does it mean first to the Hebraic Jews and then to the Hellenist Jews, first to the Jews from Judea and then to Jews in the diaspora who speak Greek, or does it mean to the Jew first and also to the Gentile? Probably the latter, but it is a matter of interpretation. The word Greek isn't 100% clear either. In this case, my guess is that it's talking about Hellenist Jews. I'm sorry, not in Romans 1:16, but in Acts 11:20 that mm-hmm. you raised okay. as an objection. Does that seem satisfying to you?
Uh-huh.
I also wanted to mention that the Latin word for gospel, which had come up last time, is simply evangelium, the transliteration from the Greek of evangelion. So the Latin version was just to was just adopted from the Greek. Some people were curious about that. And the English gospel, according to the Oxford English Dictionary at least, came from a word meaning good tidings. So it was a kind of literal translation or calque. But it was later misunderstood as being God's spell, in other words, God's story, what God had said. Oh. So there was a confusion between a good story and God's story, and both became passed on as derivations of the word. So you can find both in the different sources. And then finally, from a couple weeks earlier in chapter 11, we noticed actually in class that in discussing the first day of the week, which appears in several places, the Jewish Greek actually says basically the first after the Sabbath or the first of the Sabbath, which is very interesting. And so that strengthens the argument, I think, because definitely the conception of time is linked to the Sabbath. But I did want to mention something that I didn't realize at the time, which is that in a couple places, it seems that the word Sabbath, sabbaton, is used to mean week. So if you look in Christian lexicons of the New Testament, they will say that one of the definitions of the word Sabbath is a week. I don't think that's exactly correct, because obviously even in describing a week that way, they're linking it to the Sabbath. But obviously it could be used to describe the period from Sabbath to Sabbath. So those are just a few points I wanted to follow up on. Anyone else want to raise an issue from before, an earlier chapter, before we move on? Okay. In that case, who can tell us about the two bumblebees?
Well, one of them was rather oblivious to certain things.
Okay. What's the story here? Just
that's a misunderstanding.
A misunderstanding.
Yes. The woman and her sister were dressed up as, or her daughter was dressed up as bumblebees, ready to go to a harvest party because they didn't believe in celebrating Easter.
Halloween.
Wow. So they went to the door. This little pirate was there and said, "Trick or treat." And the mother said, "I'm sorry, we don't celebrate Halloween."
And closed the door.
And the kid was like, dressed up, bumblebee. It's Halloween, you're dressed up in a costume. So what do you mean? It just didn't make sense.
Please don't always see
What's him. The point of the story? Yep, Jackie.
I think that for people trying to change secular traditions or secular celebrations to make them more biblical, to an outsider who doesn't understand the context, who doesn't understand the distinction, it's just going to seem kind of like hypocrisy because they're not seeing any difference between harvest party with no focus on pagan entities or demons or traditions of handing out candy and just someone being stingy and being weird saying we don't celebrate Halloween when they're dressed up in a costume on Halloween night.
Right.
Things are not always as they seem.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you can't tell by looking at this person that she doesn't celebrate Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
And
kind of looks to me like she does.
It looks like she does, yes. Even if in a different guise. And so that's part of the story with Christianity, I think, that's described in this chapter, that it gives out very different impressions to different people. Let me start off, actually, by reading the beginning of A Tale of Two Cities, because it might be worthwhile to remind ourselves of what it says, and this passage is based on that.
Yeah.
So, this is Charles Dickens. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light, it was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, it was the winter of despair. We had everything before us, we had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven, we were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received, for good or for evil, in the superlative degree of comparison only. I think it's one of the most famous openings of an English language novel. What do you think he's trying to say?
It's multifaceted.
Mm-hmm.
That everything was there for your taking.
Okay.
The possibilities were just there for you to go everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else?
I think that there was so much going on, but the focus was that it had to be the ultimate in whatever was going on. It was either the best or the worst. It wasn't just like, it's mediocre, this is meh.
Right.
The focus was on the present being the ultimate of something, whether it were good or bad.
Yeah, it was an age of extremes.
Mm-hmm. Depends on who you were. That you would have that point of view. Mm-hmm. So if you were in poverty and you were slaving away 16 hours a day, child laborers, mm-hmm. in England, it was the worst of time. Mm-hmm. But if you were one of the barons and you were going on a steamship or using the railroads for the first time, you know, new inventions were coming out, it was the best of times.
Right. Actually, Dickens wrote a lot about the Industrial Revolution. Mm-hmm. And the Industrial Revolution certainly was the best of times and the worst of times. I mean, it brought about unbelievable progress that the world had never seen before. And it brought about incredible misery in terms of the working conditions for the laborers and so forth. So that's part of what he's trying to bring out, I think. Not necessarily that issue, but that kind of a dichotomy in life. And so on page 186, we have a similar passage. A derivative passage. Would anyone like to read that? Just under the heading Christianity.
It was the best of religions. It was the worst of religions. It brought life, love, and compassion to a dark and cruel world. It also brought torture, repression, ignorance, slavery, and death to an innocent world. It burned with light and truth. It also burned the Bible and those who believed it. Those who adhered to it built universities, hospitals, and orphanages. They also justified poverty, exploitation, war, and conquest. They brought food to the hungry, medicine to the sick, work to the destitute, hope to the hopeless. They filled the earth with contempt for man, contempt for God's creation, and contempt for God. What is this thing called Christianity? The Bible does not tell us. The Bible talks about something else.
Okay. It's a good question, though. What is Christianity? If you look at history, it's very hard to figure out. And there are many competing definitions of it. Does anyone have any initial reaction to this dichotomous description of Christianity?
Well, I don't think it's just Christianity. I think in the name of all religions, things have been done that were horrific and terrific.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it depended on what end of the giving you were on. But clearly between the Crusades and... even today with fundamentalist Islam and every religion and even almost every sect of every religion has had their times of torment and triumph.
Okay, but is there something special about Christianity that would cause us to single it out?
It can mean...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. To me it means so many things. I always assumed that if the word Christianity or Christ was in the name of the religion mm-hmm. or in the name of the group, that they were believers. And to my amazement, I found out that like for the Christian fundamentalists, what they have Christian, the Nazis, the the white supremacists—they have
They have Christian identity.
Christian identity.
Right.
And so you look at something like that and you realize that it has nothing to do with the Christ that you assumed. I assumed that was a believing organization. But right. I'm hit with what really is behind it.
Okay.
And it has nothing to do with that.
Truth is a very dangerous thing to have. It can either make you really, a good person or a real evil person trying to push it on everybody else by force.
And a lot of things were done in the name of Christianity or any other religion that weren't necessarily of that religion. I mean, it clearly, if you were following the tenets of the Bible's teachings and the teachings of Tanakh, you weren't going to go out and, be this murderous rampage through people. Either believe what I believe or I kill you, So there was a lot that was done in the name of religion by people who weren't necessarily religious.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point. I think also, though, Christianity has a special position for many of us. Obviously, it's focused on in this book throughout, but I think it has a special position because it did claim to be following Jesus. Mm-hmm. And so if you regard him as the truth, then you regard these people as those who are claiming to follow the truth. Whereas for most of us, or maybe all of us in this room, Islam is not the truth, Buddhism is not the truth, Hinduism and so forth. So there may have been good and evil people who followed those religions as well, but there's something different about Christianity because it claims to be following the person that we identify as the truth. And I think this description of Christianity is very accurate and very important because Christianity did represent all these different extremes throughout most of its history. You can find people who were what we tend to call saints, people who were not necessarily saints according to some official church definition, but in how they lived. They were extremely considerate of other people, and they lived a life of self-sacrifice and so forth. And then you find the general pattern, which is one of Christianity being used to justify acts of oppression throughout history. And it's not just specific incidences like the Crusades and the Inquisition, but the whole life of medieval Europe, which was built on something called Christianity, which I would say was not biblical, but claimed to be biblical. And so the point that's being made here is that Christianity means many different things. And it often means the most extremely different kinds of things. It could be with regard to Jews. Some Christians dedicated their lives to exterminating Jews. Some Christians dedicated their lives and lost their lives to save Jews. But it could be just with regard to other issues of life as well, such as building universities, hospitals, and orphanages, or slaughtering thousands of people in colonies in Africa and Asia and so forth. All of these things were done by Christianity. So what is Christianity? It's a hard question. It's hard to define what Christianity is. Whatever definition you have has to include all of these different things. So I don't know what the appropriate definition for Christianity is, but in the last part of what Bobby read, there's an interesting statement. The Bible does not tell us. The Bible talks about something else. So in a sense, it's not all that important to define Christianity for the biblical believer, because that's not what the Bible is concerned with. The Bible is concerned with something else, and that's in the subtitle of this chapter, God Never Established Any Religion. It's not a religion that God established. Instead, God established something else. So any questions or comments on that so far? It's not the usual picture that one gets, but I think it lies at the foundation or the root of everything else that's going to be discussed in this chapter. Yes?
Well, one of the questions you said a little earlier was about why does Christianity stand out so much in our history? And I think for us it's more of a regional thing because our culture predominantly came from Western Europe, and Western Europe, the government and such, adopted this religion.
Right.
Spread. I mean, I think if we were in the Middle East, that it might not stand out as much because that's more of an Arab-dominated or a Muslim-dominated society that, while those two religions have coexisted back to the same time period when Christianity was adopted by the Roman Empire, that this became more of a socialization agent for us and spread so that this is what we were taught and this was how we spread out from Europe and such as nations and cultures and groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but people were very adamant about their beliefs and religion. Columbus went to America with the idea of converting the Indians, and you know, it was a powerful thing, powerful idea. I think the difference between Christian and Christian is that one Christian, the world revolves around him, and the other Christian revolves around God. I think that's a basic difference, if, you know, or Mishihi, if you want, you know, Messianic person.
Okay.
Like or Jew.
Yeah, could you read the first full paragraph on page 187? It starts with the different faiths.
The different faiths of these opposite kinds of Gentiles, those who love and those who hate, have been called by the same name, Christianity, with a content that varies from divine to the demonic. A billion people today call this their religion. It is strange that such opposites travel under the same banner. It is hard for a little pirate to figure out.
So here we come to the bumblebees. Because basically you have different kinds of bumblebees here. One claiming to celebrate Halloween and the other kind dressing up on Halloween but claiming not to celebrate it. And it's hard to figure out what's going on. It doesn't appear to be any different. And so that's the analogy here for Christianity, of course, that actually they do fall under the same banner, all these different kinds of people. These opposite kinds of Gentiles have been called by the same name. But the book goes on to describe the contradiction, of course. There are at least two different kinds of something called Christianity, and many different kinds of people who call themselves Christians. Regardless of which group we have in mind when we use these words, these are not God's categories. The scriptures do not teach Christianity. Is that a problematic statement?
No, because they've taken what was Messianic Judaism and they've changed enough of it that it's not recognized as Judaism anymore because it took so many of the rituals. Like, they don't celebrate the festivals and stuff. And they've gone off almost to, like, another sect of Judaism somewhere, but without the Jewish part.
Okay.
If that makes sense. So, it was a schism of sorts where they went off believing in the Messiah, but not celebrating the Messiah the way the Messiah is said to be celebrated.
So this is a fairly self-evident point.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
So do you think most people who believe the Bible would accept it?
No.
Why not?
Because they're part of the sect of Christianity.
So what? How would you explain it to them? I mean, what has to change?
I just tell them they're wrong and they need to get a life. But maybe that's why they don't listen. It's almost impossible to teach this to Christians who have grown up in the church or those who are as steadfast in Christianity as we are to Messianic Judaism.
Mm-hmm. Because the accumulated force of centuries of tradition is very hard to break. But what do you say to people who clearly are believers in God and believers in the God of the Bible? In other words, they're not just nominative Christians, but they actually believe. And they say, well, those people who did those bad things weren't really Christians. Mm-hmm. That's a very common argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
That's what I would say. In my experience, Christianity is education, reform, justice, righteousness. Mm-hmm. That's what I describe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
Those ideals.
I mean, she was saying how it depends on who it is. Well, in my experience, that's exactly what it's the best thing that happened to India.
Okay.
It's the best thing that happened to the world, in my opinion. Uh-huh. I mean, there's just stories throughout the world of people who have, because of they were Christians, they stood up in the face of injustice, they made social reforms. So that's my question.
Right, that's true. But is there the other side also? Even in India, for example, with the Sepoy Mutiny. I mean, right, but I mean, massacres of Indians were also justified on the basis of Christianity and exploitation of resources and so forth. So is there the other side? And is that, can you really say, well, that's not Christianity?
I am saying that.
Okay.
No, I think if they don't follow the teachings of Yeshua, then they obviously are not believers. They can call themselves anything they want. Because Christian identity calls themselves Christians, and so do Mormons, and so do Jehovah's Witnesses, and so do all these other people, but they believe in a different Jesus. So you have all these people believing in a different Jesus, which leads them to a different God, which is not the same God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So, but they still call themselves Christians. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mitt Romney was calling himself a Christian all this time, and clearly the Mormon Church has a completely different Jesus than the Jesus of the Bible and the Tanakh. So
then you have all of that, and then among the Christians that really do believe in the right God and in the right Jesus, you have people that believe in it, but they're really not following it. Then you have people that are following it, and then there are people that are really, really living it and walking with God. So you have all these different things going on, all under the supposing big umbrella that you get to. You have extremes.
But then you also have a lot of paganism mixed in there. The celebration of Christmas, the celebration of Easter, mm-hmm. these types of things. All these types of rituals that have been added into the Christian religion under paganism. Mm-hmm. So are these really Christians? Well, we know there are some people that are real saved believers who have professed Christianity as their faith. But I think there's a whole lot of misled people, and it's very difficult to explain this to them.
Okay, anyone else have an opinion on this topic?
First of all, we're very social creatures, and we follow what our forefathers taught us, whether what society we're from. And it's a way of honoring our society, too. I mean, it's hard to break away from your society. I mean, who wants to be an outcast? And the second thought I had was, true worship and stuff like that, there's a price to be paid for it. Look at Cain and Abel. Cain slew Abel, and Abel knew the right way to worship God, and Cain hated him, and slew him because he thought his way was right.
Or at least he didn't want to admit it was wrong.
Here we have the truth again, being a powerful, weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the problem is that it's so much tradition. If it's called Christianity, then that's what it is. Everybody in the world knows that churches are part of Christianity. And if you go to church, that you're a Christian. Now, whether you follow Jesus, whether you obey the word, I mean, that happens in every congregation. You have some people who follow the words of Jesus, some people who are nominal, some people who are just, sheep in wolves' clothing, and that's going to happen. Wolves and sheep's
clothing. So, it was kind of interesting.
Okay, yep.
I guess one thing that came to my mind as we were discussing all these different kinds of people who call themselves Christian is what is the importance of asking if the people who did things in the name of Christianity but aren't followers based on what the ideas of this main figure are, what is the importance of asking that question when there's so much stratification, there's so many differences? I'm wondering if that's taking away from what the real focus should be. Because to that little pirate, it doesn't matter what the explanation of the elder bumblebee was, because they're going to see it as just two bumblebees, one's just very stingy on the candy. Mm-hmm. And if they're really not going to care about anything else, I guess, except for not getting candy and being a little miffed about that, unless they have a reason to. And so I'm wondering, like, just because it isn't authentic, I think because it's known in a general sense for the wrong reasons as Christianity, that we can't really say that. I know that it's not Christian based on actions, but historically it was under Christianity. So right. I think to not call it Christian, even though in essence it's not the faith, is just confusing and distracting for other people. Right. Although I don't know if I'm saying that well, because even as I'm trying to say that, I'm just confusing myself.
Right. No, I think that's good point. I want to add to that, though, that for most people who did things in the name of Christianity, as some of you are using that expression, they were being faithful to the faith of Christianity at that time. They were not being faithful to what we understand as biblical faith, but they were being faithful to what the church said was Christianity, what Christianity was defined as at that time. And it began even very early. Obviously, we're focusing on the question of separating from Jews. Ignatius of Antioch, who is cited in this chapter, said, "It is monstrous to talk of Jesus Christ and to practice Judaism." Okay, so obviously he believed in a kind of separation of the two. And Martin Luther also said, Christ and Moses can never agree. So when people acted accordingly, they were acting in accordance with the religion of the time. People who acted in a certain way that we consider erroneous from our biblical perspective were not being unfaithful to their Christianity. They were not being unfaithful to their religion, which is one reason why it's hard to separate the different kinds of Christianity and to say that, well, these people weren't real Christians. Another reason, I think, is that if you do that, we'd probably have to separate most of Christians from Christianity. In other words, most people throughout most of time who have called themselves Christians haven't been Christians, we'd have to say, which becomes problematic because words have meaning that develops over time, and the meaning of Christian encompasses all those people, like Martin Luther and Ignatius of Antioch. And to give another example, let me just ask a question. Is the Pope a Christian?
I don't think so.
Some might have been and some might not have been. God has a remnant within Christianity.
Well,
it's
a
small remnant, you know, but it's a remnant within the, you know.
But I'm not asking if he was a part of God's remnant. I'm asking if he's a Christian.
Only God.
He thinks he is.
We're again going
by a banner under that broad banner. Yes, he is.
Yeah, by the broad banner, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we don't all have to have the same opinion on this question. I mean, different people define Christianity in different ways, and if you were to look in a dictionary, I think you'd find more than one definition given. But the point that's being made here is that the common understanding of Christianity encompasses all of these different people and all of these different things. And to redefine Christianity so that it doesn't include the Pope, for example, would seem silly to most people.
Mm-hmm. Yet the Pope sees it fit to redefine Christianity. It doesn't include Protestants.
Right.
But
so it's all about definitions now, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's stated at the end. It's the Humpty Dumpty problem. When I use a word, it means exactly what I want it to mean. Nothing more, nothing less.
Right.
It was also Paul's admonition here in Thessalonians, 2 Thessalonians 2.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "So then, brethren, stand firm and hold to the traditions which you were taught, whether by word of mouth or by letter from us." And I think he's referring back to the traditions of our faith, the festivals and those types of things, because he knew that there would be people who want to make changes to it. And that was important to him, that they knew to stay faithful to the traditions that they were taught, not to add things and go carrying on.
What verse was that?
2 Thessalonians 2:15.
Of course, it could be a little problematic depending on how you interpret traditions. Mm-hmm. People have various understandings of that too, but it might be what he was referring to. Did you think that that helped to explain this issue?
I think it helps to understand how different, how there is, when I think of the faith mm-hmm. of Yeshua, of our faith as Messianic believers, I think of biblical Judaism. I think of following Tanakh and, you know, Torah, the prophets, and the New Covenant, and these teachings that have been provided for us. The additions of traditions that were not part of that original faith, I think, is what changes the whole game. It takes away from, it doesn't add to, the faith, and it complicates things, and it brings division among the people.
Right. And I think this chapter is suggesting that we therefore separate the whole idea of Christianity from the idea of following in God's ways. That it's, the two are not equal, and they shouldn't be confused. So a lot of you in the discussion, I think, were already at that next stage to a certain extent of separating between who's really walking in God's ways and who's not. But many people, coming from a Christian perspective, associate that with being Christian or not being Christian. And the argument here, at least, is that we shouldn't think those two things are the same. When Dickens was writing, he could say it was the best of times and the worst of times and be true when he said both. The same can be said of Christianity. It was the best of religions, it was the worst of religions. It brought life, love, and compassion to a dark and cruel world. It also brought torture, repression, ignorance, slavery, and death to an innocent world. So we shouldn't...
How innocent is the world, though, really?
Yeah. Well, I think every generation's born innocent. They don't know what's going on, and they're taught. They believe what they're taught, and if you're taught a lie, you know, you think of Martin Luther King, or Martin Luther.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many generations had he been reading about how horrible the Jews were? And it's just, you know, when he was in little school, you know, little boy, his parents, other people, and you have these prejudices, and it just will totally blind you to what the Bible says, let alone walking in love. I mean, it's like...
Right.
I spent a week out at the Tools for Tolerance conference, which was put on by the Holocaust Museum in Los Angeles. And one of the things that we had to do was to find a way to change the world. And amazingly, every study has shown that when you take white supremacists, black separatists, or other people that are filled with hate, the one time when they're willing to actually consider another way is right after they give birth to a child. Because they have hopes and dreams for this child of theirs that they're not going to feel the hate and the despair and the hopelessness that they all felt. And in the Tools for Tolerance thing, they were saying that the best place to try to exert change in the world is in like pediatric offices, to put out brochures about, you know, God or whatever. And that would be a way of changing the world, because that's when parents, as grown-ups, are most susceptible to change and also willing to teach it to their children. So I think in the realm of having this study, you can see where these different things have come up over time, and how to get back to them maybe would be to start when they're very little and make sure that our children understand this.
Yeah, so the Muslims argue too, but they use it for the other.
They use it for hate, exactly. But they understand that, and that's why they go after it so strongly in kindergarten and nursery school and even earlier. To raise these fighters and bombers. Hitler did too, which is why he also outlawed homeschooling. You're not allowed to homeschool in Germany because it was the way of getting them into the indoctrination centers called schools. And they're still fighting that today, trying to get homeschooling allowed in Germany. It's kind of a leftover from the old days of Hitler. Mm-hmm. So,
one thing I was thinking was that another way to deal with ignorance is to confront it with truth. Because if you have people, and how to do this, though, is the hard part. But in terms of, like, Leslie, how you were saying, Martin Luther, how many generations he had heard about how awful the Jews were, and it's just, if he didn't know, I mean, if all he has in his mind is this mythical idea of what a Jew is, and it looks something like a gargoyle or something, almost, to that effect, because of the way he's been taught, but he's never actually been introduced to an actual Jew, all he's going on is this myth. And sometimes when you bring the myth in direct confrontation with truth, then it's easier to let go of those traditions and long-held misbeliefs, because the truth is going to prevail in the end no matter what. So if you have someone who's grown up hating a people or hating a group, I think it's often due to severe isolation.
Mm-hmm. Do you know places where they've actually used this? I can think of two countries that are using this very tool right now to bring youth together from two sides that hated each other. Can you think of any?
Ireland
is one.
Israel.
And Israel, exactly. Mm-hmm. They're bringing the Catholics and the Protestants together in Ireland, yeah, and the Jews and the Palestinians together in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
For just such a program.
Yeah, good.
For the record, the usual interpretation that's given of Luther is that initially he expected the Jews to sign on to his new version of Christianity, and when they didn't, he became very angry and turned against them, and that. So most presentations sort of divide his life into two in that respect. But he also wrote tracts against the peasants. He used his understanding of Christianity to justify very brutal suppression of the German peasant revolts against the oppression of feudalism, essentially. So again, Christianity could mean many different things. Most of us wouldn't exclude Martin Luther from being a Christian or the Pope from being a Christian. Some of us might. That's okay. But we should at least recognize that for most people, Christianity encompasses all of these different kinds of things. And that includes, by the way, Arabs and Muslims who have a particular vision of Christianity that also comes from the Crusades and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it's important to try to separate Christianity out from biblical faith. One of the reasons why Christianity came to represent not only good to the world, but also a significant amount of evil, is related even to the introduction of this book, Copernicus and the Jews. And that's what Pascal is talking about in the middle of page 187. It is not the decree of Rome which will prove that the earth remains at rest. In other words, Rome felt that its decrees would prove whatever it wanted to prove. You know, if Rome decreed something, that was it. That settled the matter. Pascal is saying, no human authority can decide what the truth is and what isn't. And just because they tell you to believe something doesn't mean it's true. And he goes on, if we had constant observations to prove that it does turn, not all the people in the world could stop it from turning, nor could they stop themselves from turning with it. In other words, the truth is the truth regardless of whether anyone believes in it or regardless of whether the authorities agree to it. Now, Pascal, by the way, was a Christian as well. And so, you know, here we have an example, even within his own writing, of the contradiction within Christianity of two extremes. But a large part of the problem with Christianity was this emphasis on a kind of slavish obedience to authority. And that's picked up on page 188 with regard to Ignatius. Um, Ignatius of Antioch, he was steeped in the Greek and Roman tradition of exalting religious officials, and he had a Gentile conception of authority. In other words, what Yeshua called the Gentile conception of authority, if you remember.
Lording it over.
Exactly. Yeah, lording it over people and calling yourself benefactor, which is the style of most rulers of the world, to rule for their own benefit, not for the benefit of the people, but to call themselves benefactors of the people. So what did Yeshua say to do instead of that?
To be a servant.
That if you want to be a leader, what that means is to make yourself a servant of each one, to be a slave. Now, by calling this the way of the nations, the way of the Gentiles, I don't think Yeshua meant that no Jews were guilty of this. Certainly some Jews were guilty of this, and you can read about that in Tanakh and in other places.
Chronicles?
but it's the way of the world. It's the way of the Goyim. And unfortunately, in the writings of Ignatius and many other Christian thinkers, authors throughout history, a lot of that idea became incorporated into the religion of Christianity. And we've talked about this in other chapters as well, but here it's coming out again because we're discussing the question of whether there should be a religion. And a large part of what makes up a religion per se is the authority, the institutional authority. So Ignatius says, let all of you follow the bishop as Jesus Christ follows the Father. Without the bishop, it is not lawful either to baptize or to celebrate a love feast. He that honors the bishop shall be honored by God. He that does anything without the knowledge of the bishop serves the devil. So, in other words, if you do anything without the permission of the authorities, you're not only in error, you're serving the devil, not God. Can you imagine? Is that the spirit of Acts? With all the believers coming together, meeting from house to house, sharing all things.
Right.
It seems much more spontaneous in Acts. It seems much...
Control.
It certainly is. It certainly is. Now, there's a verse in the scriptures that says, you've been bought with a price, don't become the slaves of men. Don't make yourself the slaves of men. But I think religion did make people slaves again. So, all of this stands in contrast to what Yeshua told his followers. Don't be like the Gentiles who lord it over one another, Luke 22. This stands in contrast to the God-established role of the prophet to challenge priest, king, and people. It supports a system that denigrates individual responsibility and freedom. So if you look at the prophets, they did not obey authority in the sense that some believers today think would be appropriate. When they spoke from God, they challenged people in authority very directly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they, I think, had the proper respect for authority, but part of that proper respect was holding the people accountable, holding people in positions of authority accountable for what they did, what they did that was right and what they did that was wrong. In a religious institutionalized system, especially of the kind described by Ignatius, that is prevented. No one has the right to do that. Anyone who does that is a heretic and sometimes worse. You know, no one has the right to hold a person in authority accountable. The person in authority is the last word. So that's the main problem, I think, with the system of religions per se, including the system of the religion of Christianity. And what does my father mean here? It supports a system that denigrates individual responsibility and freedom. Yeah.
You don't have to take responsibility for your actions so much because you're just a follower. You don't have to think for yourself, is this what God wants me to do? Because you've just trusted that, oh, I'm doing whatever the bishop okays. And you don't have the freedom to be proactive. If God says, I want you to go build a church here, I want you to do this ministry, and you don't have the responsibility to look after people who are being wrongly persecuted by authority because you've just yielded and given up and been like, I'm just following that guy. That guy is supposedly who's in charge.
Right. It removes the burden and the privilege of responsibility, both, from you.
Mm-hmm.
You're just doing, supposedly at least, what someone else has told you to do. Now, within these religious systems, people didn't always do what they were told to do, but there was some sort of system whereby they weren't seen as rebelling, at least. They pretended in some way, perhaps. But yeah, if you're in this kind of a system where the authority, the human authority, cannot be questioned, what it means is that you no longer have freedom. You are no longer a free person, as God intended you to be. Mm-hmm. Now, this is also the kind of excuse that people have used frequently to try to excuse themselves from heinous actions. For example, during the Holocaust, mm-hmm. I was just following orders, right? Mm-hmm. And this is not just the Holocaust. I mean, this comes up in the news regularly, whether it's American soldiers or mm-hmm. Serbian soldiers or what have you. It always comes up. Does that excuse an individual's actions, or is each individual responsible for his or her own actions? I think the biblical view is that each person is responsible for his or her own actions and has the right and the responsibility to choose. Mm-hmm. And God holds each person responsible. So a controlling system like that distorts and prevents that reality from taking place. Another example from the Holocaust, there was a man who lived through the camps, Viktor Frankl, who became a famous psychologist and wrote Man's Search for Meaning, a book that he wrote afterwards. And in that book, he said something interesting. I don't have the exact quote here, but basically he described how, in a sense, the Nazi attempt to destroy the soul of the Jew, the soul of the human being, was successful among some people. They became like animals to a certain extent, but there were others who, down to the very last moment, would go through the camps encouraging people, sharing their little crumbs of bread mm-hmm. with them, and so forth. And he said, this proves that you can take everything from a man except the last freedom, the freedom to determine how you will act in any situation, how you will respond. And that's a freedom that God has given to people, the freedom to choose, the freedom to decide how to respond to circumstances. And every system of control attempts to take that freedom away from people and to force them into a particular way of behaving, acting, thinking, believing. The examples that we're most familiar with are probably from our own lifetimes, you know, totalitarian regimes, communism in Russia and Eastern Europe, Nazism and so forth. But it shows up in all sorts of other ways as well, every day.
But the one thing they tried to strip the Jews of, their humanity, and to make them more like animals and stuff, was actually what happened to their Nazi soldiers.
Sure.
They became less than human beings themselves and
right.
very much animalistic.
It's ironic, isn't it?
It is.
You reap what you sow. Yeah.
That sounds biblical.
What goes around comes around.
That sounds 70-ish.
You dig a ditch, you fall in it.
Right. Right. I don't think the Nazis could actually do what they were trying to do. Mm-hmm. Of course, mm-hmm. to destroy the soul. I mean, it even says in the scriptures that you shouldn't fear the one who kills the body, but right, fear the one who can throw both body and soul into hell.
Yeah.
But if you were to go around in the concentration camps and look at the people, it would certainly seem like most people were reduced to an animal type existence. They were still people. They still had their souls. But that was the appearance. But even in that situation, you could tell that people still had the freedom to choose how they would act.